We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Good morning. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce Rabbi Natan, Dr. Natan Lopez Cardozo. Rabbi Cardozo and Torah in Motion are fast friends. We've invited him several times here to speak. My wife and I have spoken several times at the Cardozo Academy in Jerusalem. Rabbi Cardozo is well known around the world as a compassionate and thoughtful ambassador for Judaism. He's the author of several books, including Judaism on Trial and Thoughts to Ponder, and his latest book, For the Love of Israel. The seminar this morning will be split into two parts. After about an hour, there'll be a break. At the break, Dr. Cardozo will be signing books. Those people who want to purchase some of his books are welcome to at that time. In 2003, Rabbi Cardozo founded the Cardozo Academy, which is named in honor of his father. And that academy continues and does vital work today in Israel. And its central focus is to train teachers, leaders, educators, rabbis of the next generation to face the multiple challenges that modernity poses for Judaism. In this morning's seminar, Rabbi Dr. Cardozo is going to address issues of halakha, spirituality, and innovation in the modern world. Won't you please welcome Rabbi Dr. Natan Lopez Cardozo.
Good morning, everybody. First of all, my thanks to Professor Elliot Melamed and Rabbi Jay Kelman for inviting me here this morning at Torah in Motion, which has a very special place in my heart because even the title I happen to love, Torah in Motion. The shiur, the lecture which I'm going to give this morning, is a lecture in motion. And I'm sure that when Torah in Motion was invented, the meaning behind emotion is that it did not yet arrive, that it is still moving. Traveling. And that's exactly what I have to say as an introduction to the lecture which I'm going to give. This lecture will not arrive. I'm just taking you on a journey. Where that journey will ultimately end, I am not sure yet myself. And perhaps it should not end. If you just continue to travel in many different directions, because only in that way perhaps we will understand what this beautiful tradition, the Jewish tradition, is all about. There is perhaps no beginning to it, and there is no end to it. It is constantly traveling. But this is not a lecture without problems, and I have to warn you for that. I'm going to say unusual things over here, which, be assured, the establishment will not accept. I'm very well aware of that, and I have no problem with that, and I even, thank you so much, I appreciate the critique, which no doubt will come to me after I've said what I will say, because I see value in that critique. That doesn't mean to say that I agree with it, but one of the most beautiful parts of the Jewish tradition is that it is a tradition of ultimate debate. And in any debate, you never come to an end. You refocus, you reestablish your ideas, and you try once more. And that's all what I'm trying to do this morning with you. And what I hope is that when you walk away, you will really have something to think about. You may be upset. You may totally disagree. You may even say that I was not radical enough. It has a lot to do with psychology. It has a lot to do with other issues in our lives which are not purely academic. But I want you to know another thing as well. In any case where people are teaching, there is a certain background music to the lecture, which is not stated, and which over a time you have to pick up. If I would lecture here for some time, and you would get used to my style and to what I represent, it will be easier to understand the lecture of this morning. Because I'm going to throw you in a kind of a music which I did not play for you, which I did not look into properly in the way as I would like to, but that's the conditions under which we have to work. I hope to convey a message which comes from a deep, deep, deep concern. A concern for the Jewish people. A concern for the future of the Jewish tradition. And therefore, I may sound sometimes academic, and know that academics has part in all this. I want you to know that I also come from a deeply emotional perspective. I'm not just speaking my mind, but I'm also speaking my heart. And it's a rare combination. When it is my heart and when it is my mind, I don't know. And you will neither know. I only know there is a music, and I want to say, so that everybody understands that point of departure quite correctly, I'm not here at all to create trouble for the sake of creating trouble. I'm not interested in that. I'm standing here for the sake of kavod shamayim, we say in Hebrew, for the honor of heaven, for the Jewish tradition, which I am incredibly in love with. And every day that I study it more, I fall more in love. I'm speaking, I dare to say this about myself, from a point of view of authenticity and integrity. I will speak from the perspective of what we call in Hebrew, Yirat Shamayim, the awe of heaven. But I realize that that may not always be understood by my audience. You don't know me, at least many of you do not know me. You have not read what I have written about topics like that before. Perhaps some of you did. And therefore, I take a risk. But life without risks is not worthwhile living. Not everything what I will say is for everybody. Not everything is meant to be for everybody. Some people should perhaps even not hear what I have to say. But also people very much need to hear what I have to say. And also, altogether, I would add one more dimension to this. And that is that what I'm going to say is a very small part of what I would like to say. I could engage you with this topic from this morning onwards till tonight without ever repeating myself because the topic is enormous. And there are so many dimensions to it. And I will sometimes have to skip certain issues which I would like to discuss. And there may be gaps in my way how I formulate myself purely because the time doesn't allow me to go in all the details. One day I hope to publish this all and then we have all the opportunity of really going into the discussion formally and completely in the ways I would like to. But all these matters are important to keep in mind. Last but not least, if you quote me afterwards, absolutely fine. Also, what some people may even consider to be heresy. The only thing what I'll ask you is, quote me correctly. If I get afterwards into trouble, then at least I should get into trouble for what I really said, not for what people made up I said. And by the way, this happens constantly, that I hear afterwards things said in my name which I never said, purely because the audience didn't understand what I was saying. So be careful. That's all what I can ask you. By the way, there's only one person who takes responsibility for this lecture, and that's me. Not Torah Motion, not anybody else. I'm standing here on my own, and that's all what I want to try to convey to you. Having said all this, and by the way, we will break this lecture up in two parts because it will be too long to hold onto it. We'll make a little break in the middle so that afterwards we can have an opportunity to re-engage ourselves again in all this. I just hope that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives me this morning the right approach, that I get myself to be clear, and that you really understand what I'm trying to get to. And again, remember, we are traveling. I'm not going to take you to the final station. I hope you will do that yourself. I hope one day to come back and show you the second part of this journey. I'm not sure yet where it will lead. It doesn't matter. I want to start with a non-Jewish thinker, a Catholic, as far as I know, non-Jewish professor of philosophy, a man who wrote most important philosophical novels, by the name of Walker Percy. Probably you have never heard of him, but he's an important voice today in some parts of the philosophical world. I became aware of him because one of our teachers in our academy in Jerusalem, Professor Yehuda Gelman, made me aware of him. There's a book of his which is called The Loss of the Creature. The Loss of the Creature, which was already printed and written in 1954. And there, Walker Percy discusses a problem in education in general. Nothing to do with Jewish education. A problem, he thinks, we encounter constantly in our universities, in our academic world, in our high schools. And the best way to put that problem into one or two words is that we have a problem which we can call prepared experience. Prepared experience. And he tells the following story as a way to introduce his problem, which introduces the problem of prepared experience in education. He tells about a Falklander Icelander, a fellow who lives in Falkland, who walks on the beach and suddenly finds there on the beach a dead dogfish, small fish. And he takes his knife, which he just happened to have with him, and he wants to know how that particular fish looks inside. So he cuts it open, removes certain parts, and keeps on having a careful look about how this fish is made, the anatomy of this particular fish. And he tries to get an insight into what is the biology of this particular fish. But he does that in a spontaneous way. He has no rules. He doesn't know how you take a fish apart. He only knows that he is able to do that because he, on his own, wants to find, to discover what this fish is all about. He says that that is one way how you can take a dogfish apart. But then there is another way. He says, what happens in the case when the same dogfish lands in front of you on your desk in Harvard University, or, as he says, in Scarsdale High School? How are you going to take that fish apart there? Well, that's a completely different story, he says. Why? Because here we have the problem of a prepared experience. On a table of every student, I suppose you remember that still from your own days, there are all sort of different knives and also instruments there. And the teacher is going to tell you how to take that particular fish apart. You use this knife for this particular part of the fish, that for that particular one. Slowly but surely, he unravels the inside of that particular fish, but it is done by way of particular rules, which the teacher sets in motion at that moment. He tells you how to do that. You can't just take that particular knife of you hack it into the fish, take it open and look yourself. No. There is, hear well what I say, there is a Shulchan Aruch. There is a code of laws how to take that fish apart. And then, says Walker Percy, we have a problem. The problem is that both these people, the fellow who walks on the beach, and the other one who is in Scarsdale, they ultimately will see two totally different fishes. Although from a purely scientific point of view, it's the same fish. But since each one of them takes it apart in a different way, the picture which ultimately will come about this fish is completely and totally different, and you probably wonder if they are actually speaking about the same fish. Why? Because one is done spontaneous. It is done in a way that whatever you want to do with that fish, you take it apart, and therefore you have a particular understanding of that fish. While in the other case, when it is not spontaneous, because the whole thing has already been set in motion by your teacher, and everything has already been told how to take that particular fish apart, what it ultimately means is that you see something quite different. What do you see? You see that what your teacher wants you to see. You don't see what you would have found and discovered on your own. Because the fish has already been discovered by your teacher, by the book which tells you how to take that particular fish apart. Not because you decided how to do that and get your own understanding, your own insights into that fish and what its biology is all about. That, says Walker Percy, is an incredible problem. The problem is that if the student in Scarsdale is being taught, as we all are, how to take the fish apart, at that very moment, we already know what you're going to find. The discovery already has been made a long time ago. You are just repeating what others have done before you. In the case when the fellow is walking in the beach, there's no repetition there at all. It is the first time that that particular fish is taken apart the way in which it has been taken apart. It also means this, and this is extremely important. Not only that the student will see different fishes in the way how they open it up, but also because one has a certain way in which the details, the biology of the fish, is being put on the table. And the other one, which is much more spontaneous, is that on the end, the sum total of that fish is seen differently. Even when you would close it up again, and then you will see just the outside of the fish, ultimately, you will now see two different fishes. Why? Because how do you see the larger picture of the fish? That depends on the details. And if the details are different, then the ultimate picture which you get on the very end, by closing it up and seeing it in its totality, will be different as well. There is obviously very little objectivity here. And be aware, I don't want to go into this now, even in the pure sciences, there are problems like that. In the pure sciences, not everything is completely objective. Even there, there are problems and emotions which play a role, while even in cases, I just read about it by one professor who wrote in great lengths about it, even when it comes to mathematics, there is no such thing as absolute objectivity. But we shall not go into this now. One of the students, the one in school, in university, has already been involved in certain obstacles of seeing it his own way. The one who is walking on the beach doesn't have that problem. But the other side is also true. That the one who is walking on the beach, because he doesn't know how to take that fish apart, will probably not see certain things of that fish. Which obviously the university professor is able to show him if he would do it his way. So there is a price to be paid on the other side as well. It's complicated. It's difficult. Walker Percy gives another example. What's about Shakespeare? How do you read Shakespeare? Are you reading Shakespeare as a prepared experience? Or are you reading Shakespeare in a way that it is really spontaneous? He makes the distinction between the fellow who is walking around somewhere, suddenly finds in somewhere in a cellar an old book, which is some of the works of Shakespeare, the Hamlet. He opens it up and he starts reading. If he's intelligent, he will get an understanding of what Shakespeare is all about and what Shakespeare is trying to say. If you take the same piece, the same page, and you get it taught in university, in some upper class of English literature, then you are being taught beforehand how to read that piece of Shakespeare. At least there are indications there, there are rules of the game. How do you do that? It may quite well be true, as we all know, that because the professor has an incredible amount of knowledge about Shakespeare, that indeed he can show you certain things about Shakespeare which the fellow who just picked up this particular book in a cellar is not able to see. But the other side is also true. Because already the professor has been telling you how to read Shakespeare, the chances that you can read Shakespeare your own way, and I don't have to tell you that, I would nearly have to say, lahavdil, you would say in Hebrew. That's true about the Torah as well. That there are so many layers and so many possibilities that yes, on the end, you probably will come to the conclusion that that Shakespeare which you are reading is quite different from the Shakespeare you would have been reading if you would have just read it on your own without having any pre-prepared experience how to read it. This says Percy Walker, Booker Percy, is an incredible problem. What he suggests, which is not ideal, but it definitely makes sense, is he says sometimes what we have to do with our students, that is to take a dogfish, put it on the table in Harvard, and not telling your students at all what to do with it, and just to tell them, hack into it. We need that experience as well. The same thing is with Shakespeare, with any literature. There may be moments that we have to say to our students, I won't get involved. I just put this page on the table for you. You just work this out yourself. Afterwards, I can tell you what I see or what our experience has been showing us for a long time. But we must have the moment of spontaneous, let's say, completely independent ways of looking to the dogfish or to Shakespeare. Otherwise, we are ultimately going to miss something. Now, what has this to do with the Jewish tradition? The answer is a lot. A tremendous lot. Because the truth is that there are two ways how you can approach the Jewish tradition. There is a spontaneous way in which you can approach the Jewish tradition by looking yourself into it. I'll show you in a moment how that would work. And there is a prepared, experienced kind of Jewish tradition where you are being told how to look into it, or perhaps even better, how do you live that kind of life. What is happening, and I will elaborate greatly on this, is that today when we speak about the essence of Jewish living, which after all is halakha, Jewish law, for lack of a better translation, the truth about it is that we have over the years become so obsessed with halakha for the sake of halakha that we may be on the very end not getting the picture of what this halachic concept is all about. If I would say, which I will as a point of departure this morning, and there's a lot of discussion about it which I cannot go into, I may indicate it, but not more than that. If we speak today about halakha, we must obviously ask ourselves the question, what is the purpose of halakha? It is not good enough, like my grandchildren will tell me if I ask them, why do we need to keep Shabbat? So my grandchildren will tell me, you are 4 or 5 years old, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us to do so. And for that child, that's the end of the story. We are being told to do so. And by the way, there are some very sophisticated thinkers today in the Jewish world who would more or less say the same. For example, Yeshaya Leibowitz. Yeshaya Leibowitz was of the opinion that ultimately there is no real deep reason philosophically to all halachot, But the most important thing is that we are commanded. There's a tzivui. There's a commandment coming from Sinai which tells us that's the way how we live. We need to live. Why? That's up to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But that's an extreme position. Most authors are of the opinion that definitely when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us the Torah and the mitzvot and the halakha, that there is a certain purpose and we are at least to a point able to, let's say, reveal that purpose. To know what it is all about. And if I would put it in very superficial terms, but still correct, then I obviously would have to say that the ultimate meaning of living a halachic life is, to use a more Hasidic expression, is dvekut Hashem, to become close to God. Now, how you can become close to God is a long and very difficult story, and there is a tremendous difference of opinion, for example, between the Lithuanian way of looking to this and the Hasidic way of looking to this. There's an enormous split about this, and both of them have a lot to say for themselves. And I shall not go into this now. But what I will say is that in principle we agree on one thing. The idea is to get closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. To perhaps, to use a more Hasidic expression, to experience HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I must feel him in my blood, in my very existence. Every time when I am involved in a halakha, I am feeling that I'm living in the presence of God, and somewhere it takes me. It transforms me. It does something very great to me. I need to live in amazement. I have to live in wonder. Because only that way I can experience that God. And the halakha, in according to many opinions, and I would personally agree with that, one of its purposes is to indeed make that possible for us. How do you experience God? A very difficult issue. Very complicated. But at the same time, that we need to walk around in this world, and I spoke yesterday in one of the shuls about this as well, is that we ultimately must feel that we are living in total amazement, and that the halakha is the way how to create that amazement, how to bring it about, how to walk away from a shul service or a synagogue service or a prayer service or anything else with a feeling like, I'm not the same person I was 5 minutes ago. To discover God in everything. But then there's a problem. Is the halakha really doing this for us? Are we not having an enormous problem, my good friends, about all this? Because instead that we serve God, we start serving the halakha itself. Are we busy living halakha for the sake of halakha? Are we living halakha for the sake of God, of having that experience of living that kind of life in the presence of God? And here I come to the point this Walker Percy is making. Are we not living today in a world of a prepared experience when it comes to halachic living? Why? Well, for very one good reason. Because we today have this important work and several works called, for example, the Shulchan Aruch, the Codex of Jewish Law, the Mishneh Torah of Maimonides, his great halachic work. It's our outstanding works, each one of them, and shows enormous, enormous learning and great Yirat Shamayim, great all for heaven as well. Nobody will doubt that. But in these particular works, everything has already been worked out for us. It will tell you exactly what to do in this situation. It will tell you exactly what to do in that situation. The whole thing has been a prepared experience. I have to look into the law. I have to look in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Mishneh Berura of the Chafetz Chaim, or anybody else. And there I get a complete overview of how do I live my life when I find myself in this or that situation. When an Orthodox Jew will ask himself, what do I need to do? He will look in the Shulchan Aruch. He will look in the Codex of Jewish Law. And there he gets an answer. Very clearly so. Now I agree that there are commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Codex of Jewish Law, which sometimes here and there will disagree with the position taken by Rabbi Yosef Karo, who is the man who wrote the Shulchan Aruch. You have the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Israelis, who is the great Ashkenazi commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, where there are differences of opinion. When there are different minhagim, there are different kinds of customs which have become part of Jewish learning and living. But the problem is this, and I hope you understand this. The problem is that the moment that we work with a codex, the moment that we are busy just following the law for the sake of the law, we possibly no longer experience the purpose of the law. Because we get so involved in the details, and I have to make so sure and clear that I do it exactly the right way, that on the end I'm so taken over and completely obsessed by making sure that I do it the right way, that therefore that what it needs to result in, what it needs to achieve in religious terms, is lost on me. I'm overwhelmed by the details in the halakha. Now, it is definitely true that details in the halakha are extremely important because, as I mentioned before as well, the Shabbat, the point obviously is that since we believe that life takes place in the presence of God, there cannot be any insignificant deed ever done by man. Every move I make in front of God. If I make a move in front of God, it must be significant. It can't be trivial. And that's one of the things the Torah, or better, the Halakha, wants us to understand. Whatever you do in life is important. You may argue about the question if you're allowed to open up a fridge on Shabbat, yes or no, because the hot air will go inside and a motor will start working. And our great poskim, our great halachic authority is right about that. Can you, can't you, and so on. We shall not go into this now. But the fact is, this is typically halachic. Why? Because the ultimate idea is, if you open up your fridge on Shabbat, you happen to do that in front of somebody. And that somebody is a capital S. It is not a trivial act. It is not insignificant. Because I'm doing this in front of the master of the universe. And in the same way that I would stand in the Buckingham Palace in England in front of the Queen, any moment that I do something what looks to be trivial, the fact that I know that she's looking over my shoulders will make me to have a different experience. The Queen is looking on. The Lord of the universe is looking on. How can it be insignificant? That's the reason why we Jews have a very interesting rule in this world. The rule is this. The rule is that of every solution, we need to make a problem. We are great in making problems. That's one of the tasks of halakha. Just keep on making problems. You know why? Because if you don't have a problem, then you really have a problem. The problem is that it becomes superficial. The problem is that it just passes by. So what do? We make the greatest problems about the most what people would call trivial issues. I mentioned yesterday, if we Jews would have a Christmas tree, we might have had loads of laws about the Christmas tree. How high, how many leaves, what are you allowed to put on top of it, how high it has to stand. And the rabbis will have all sorts of differences of opinion about that, because after all, that's the way how the halakha works. The Christians haven't learned this yet. Don't tell them. But what I'm saying here is something which I believe is extremely, extremely important. If everything is already worked out for us, if the whole thing is already on a Shulchan Aruch, a laden table, this you do them, this you do them, and I'm so busy with all the details, on the end I won't see the big picture. On the end, God is actually exiled. He's no longer there. I'm only busy, I stand in awe of the halakha instead that I stand in awe of God. And that's a major problem, my dear friends. And that's exactly what, in secular terms, Walker Percy is speaking about. The problem of an experience which is prepared, everything is worked out, there is little spontaneity that way. There is little religious feeling at the time. There is no personal, or nearly no personal discovery. Things are done automatic. We do this in shul, when we go to the synagogue, we say automatically our prayers. When we say Birkat HaMazon, when we thank God for the food which we ate, we do this automatically. Many of us are thinking about something else, at least that's what happens to me, and while we are saying the other words. And then you have to ask yourself, am I on the right track? Is this is what it is all about? Is this what Jewish learning, or better, Jewish living is all about? Are we not, to put it in different terms, having a problem here that there is a lot of observance, but there is little religiosity? There's a lot of observance, but there's little religiosity. What do you do about this? And my friends, you should know, we are living today in very unusual times in this respect. If I walk into a bookshop today, in a Jewish bookshop today, and I go to the department of where halachic works, also in English, are being shown, and where I can buy them. Today, the amount of halachic works, even in English, about every little detail about which they manage to write a whole book, yes, makes me incredibly nervous. To be honest, I use these books. They're marvelous in the sense that if I quickly need to know what an answer to a problem is, I look it up, because everything is worked out carefully, A, B, C, and so on. It's all there, right in the right chapters. The whole thing is worked out. But at the same time, I get incredibly nervous, because I ask myself, what's going on over here? What are these people doing? With respect. What they are doing is, they collect all the information of all the other halachic works which have been written over the time, put it in the right order, that it's all very clear how it needs to be followed up, and there it is. By the way, there is nearly no creative thinking there at all. It is the repetition of also what also people have been writing over the years. The knowledge is enormous. The spontaneity is completely absent. The question about the religion and religiosity is non-available, non-existent. In England, somebody wrote a book about tzniut, tznius, about modesty. Book like this, written by a rabbi I know very well, who is a tremendous Talmid Chacham, who knows really a stuff inside out. And he writes exactly mainly about women, how they need to dress, how far here, or here, I'm not sure, how long the leaves, and so on, with pictures, drawings, a book like this. I cannot argue probably with anything what he wrote in there. But I wrote him a letter. I didn't get an answer. I said to him, you have it completely wrong. You know why? Not because anything in the book. I'm sure that some halachic personalities will probably disagree with you on certain issues. But the whole point is that this is no way to teach the Jewish tradition. These are things which should be stay, as we say in Hebrew, baal pei. They have to go from mother to daughter, from daughter to another daughter. These are things which need a certain flexibility in the way in which they pass on from one generation to the next. You can't codify everything. That's the last thing what we should do. You know why? Because on the end, I have a granddaughter who goes to, a lovely girl, who goes to a seminar, I'm not going to tell you where they are reading and they're learning that book. And she comes home and every time again she tells her parents that she needs to get new garments because the last one don't live up to this particular book. And I said to her when she was staying with me a few weeks ago, I said to her, have you ever thought about an also halachic problem that you're putting your parents into great financial trouble because every week you have an also dress? But the teacher didn't tell them that. And I wrote a very critical letter to this rabbi, who I personally know, asking him what he was doing over there. Forgive me for saying this. Are we in the Vatican, in Rome? Or are we in Jerusalem, where there is a certain way how we deal with halachic issues, which can't just be written down? You have to realize one thing. Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of Rabbi Yosef Beer Soloveitchik in New York, wrote, or best of all, in Boston, once wrote an article in which he said, we have become too much a book people. A book people in the sense that we are now following the books. But if you look into Jewish tradition, we were definitely involved in books, but we also had a oral tradition, which went from one generation to the next. Where not everything was in according to the book either, by the way. I could give you loads of examples for that. It left a certain flexibility, and it kept alive the idea is that what orally is moved from one generation to the next still holds to spontaneity. There's still music there. There are still colors there. There's a lot of other very interesting things which are part of the package of what it means to live a Jewish life. But now, everything is a matter of a book. Everything is to be looked up. An experience which is prepared. And Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, may quite well get lost in the middle of all this. Because on the end of the day, many Orthodox Jews should ask themselves one question, including myself. Am I serving the halacha, or am I serving God? Big problem. Then there is another problem, which I want to look into for a moment. And that is this. We live today in a world totally different from our grandparents. We are not aware yet how much our world is different. We are living in a world of pluralism, of independence, of autonomy. These are very important, crucial words today in the society in which we live. After all, we are deeply influenced by the modern world. The modern world is everywhere around us, and even the yeshiva world, even Mea Shearim, can't completely escape the influence of that enormous world on that little world of ours, because we are a very little, small, little world over there. We are most unusual, but we are very small. We are living today in a world of democracy. We are living in a way, in a world where we say that all men are equal. We are living in a way of what I call an open marketplace of ideas. Anybody can pick up any information on the internet at any time. There is no way to escape that. We hear about many different attitudes which our grandparents has never heard about. We hear about all sorts of things which we would not so long ago understand to be completely impossible, and today it is all there right in front of you. We have choices in this world today which no generation ever had. Not just choices physically about our, let's say, condition as far as our physical world is concerned and our comfort. I'm speaking about ideas, about ideologies, about philosophies, about insights. We are living today in a world which is already beyond modernism. Our whole worldview, rightly or wrongly, I shall not go into this now, has changed tremendously. And in that world, law, codex, conformity is no longer accepted as it used to be the case with our great-grandparents. They lived still in the Victorian world, let's say. There are rules. There is moral criteria there. You know, today there is a philosophy around this world that says there is no morality at all. And it's all made up by man. And we should totally leave this behind because it doesn't get us anywhere. We have gone through a radical change of at least 180 degrees, if not more than that. More freedom. But that also means at the same time more rebellion. More people who demonstrate, who stand up and no longer accept the system. And how is this going to work with the Jewish tradition? In the Jewish tradition, there is a tremendous need, we are being told, for conformity. To hold on to a particular way. You live in a particular way. You do the same things. We go to the same kind of shuls and we say the same kind of prayers. Conformity is reft and light, and the Torah seems to constantly speak about it because it says very often that we have to live the mishpat achat lekulam. It should be one law for everybody. We have rabbinical authority. which will tell us ultimately what is right and what is wrong. And we have even something which I have no clue what it means, but I shall not go into this now, which we hear lately. We have something, I can only say this in the Ashkenazi pronunciation, we have Das Teure. Da'at Torah. Which means to say, suddenly there is something which says, there is only one way how the Torah thinks about every topic in the world. And who tell us what that particular way is? It are the great rabbis. Strangely enough, these great rabbis themselves, when they claim they have Da Torah, come up with all sorts of different ideas which clashes all the times. And one has to understand why that is, by the way. But the question about individualism, the question about autonomy, about independence, about all these particular matters which today are standing at the very, let's say, center of our societies in which we live. And we Jews, we Orthodox Jews, we religious Jews can't escape any one of them. They are there for us to pick up, and we are challenged by them, and we see then a problem. The problem is that we have conformity, and the whole world is asking non-conformity. The world speaks about the individual, and we keep on speaking about community. And these things somewhere clash. Independence and following rabbis are very problematic issues. How do you combine them? How do you reconcile them? So we have to ask this. We have to ask the question, if indeed that is the case, and we know much more about this conformity and individualism and autonomy than our grandparents did, then we have to ask ourselves, does the Jewish tradition still fit into the world in which we live? Or is it indeed not outdated by now? And it hasn't got the chance to be and create a future for us because it clashes ultimately with these incredible values, which I'm not saying that all these values of autonomy and independence are always right. But one thing I do know, we are living right in that particular hour, in our history, in our world. I'm going to quote here a Jewish philosopher who was not religious at all, but for whom I have tremendous respect. An English-Russian Jewish philosopher, who was always proud about being Jewish but did not live a Jewish life. Sir Isaiah Berlin. I'm sure you have heard that name. Sir Isaiah Berlin. Great Russian English philosopher who taught in Oxford in England and wrote mainly about matters related to politics and activism and things like that. Isaiah Berlin is a very interesting man. He claimed himself to be an atheist, but he made sure that on the end of his life he was buried in an Orthodox Jewish cemetery. He used to have a seder at his home because he believed that there were great things within the Jewish tradition, even so he considered himself to be a non-believer. I want to read you one or two statements of his, which I think have a lot to do with our discussion. Isaiah Berlin discusses the question, is there such a thing as the ultimate good condition? That is to say, is there an ideal way of living which all of us should live by and then everything will fall in place? You want shalom in this world? You want peace in this world? Well, there are rules how to get to the peace, and people keep on claiming throughout history that they found that particular way of living, and if you just follow it, everything will be fine. What is the reason why there is war in this world? What is the reason why there is so much diversity and so many disagreements in this world? It's only because people have not yet found the truth. And the moment they found the truth, everything would be fine. Says Isaiah Berlin, not true at all. The reverse is true, he says. He says, the moment that we start to speak about what he calls salvation, about redemption, about the final solution, about a classless society, about the preservation of the nation, even when we speak about globalization, even when we speak about democracy, he says you should know one thing. There are no such things in this world which are absolutely watertight, where if you just follow them, everything will fall in place and things will be fine. You know why? Because values clash. And it is not because one is wrong and the other one is right. It is because by definition they are different. It depends how you look to something. And in according to that you will say, this I want to live by, but I'm aware that I'm paying a price somewhere else. And there is no way out of that. There is no ideal way of living you can just buy into and say everything is under control. He writes, and I quote him over here, I cannot conceive of any world in which certain values can be reconciled, however great these values are. I believe, in other words, that some of the ultimate values by which man lives cannot be reconciled or combined, not just for practical reasons, but conceptually. Nobody can be both a careful planner and at the same time be completely spontaneous. You cannot combine full liberty with full equality. Full liberty for the wolves cannot be combined with the liberty of the sheep. Justice and mercy, knowledge and happiness can collide. Here it is. Justice and mercy, knowledge and happiness can collide. If that is true, then the idea of a perfect solution of human problems cannot be created in this world. They are utopian ideas which have nowhere any root within reality. Such solutions want to combine the incombinable. So what then do we need to do in this world? Says Isaiah Berlin, you know what we need to do in this world? Only one thing. You can only try to work with what he calls trade-offs. Try to bring some balance between all these clashes, which there's no way how to solve them. At any time. And he gives loads of examples to show you that indeed there is no such thing. Communism didn't work, you know why? Because communism was saying there's only one way of living and that's it. It ultimately got destroyed. He says this even about democracy. He says, for democracy we pay a price. Democracy can be sometimes incredibly unfair to certain people. There is nothing you can do about that. He says, how much equality, how much liberty should we give people? How much justice, how much mercy, how much kindness, how much truth. It is all a matter of a trade-off, of finding some kind of a balance, but you keep on having all sorts of clashes left and right. And if you stand on this side and you live that way, then it is fine, but remind yourself of the fact that it will clash somewhere. And if you stand on the other side, that's also fine. You did your best. But don't think that you have the final answer to the problems which you try to solve. The utopian idea doesn't exist. Then the question comes back to us, the Jewish tradition. Don't we speak about an utopian concept? Don't we say that ultimately if we live in according to the halakha, everything will fall in place? If we just follow the laws of the Torah, everything will be fine? That there will no longer be any tension and it's only because we don't and therefore we have all the problems which we have? Berlin is telling us that's not true at all. There is no such thing. And indeed, we must agree that that is indeed the case. Because of all of history, Jewish and non-Jewish history has been showing us that the world exists out of trade-offs between different values. So how can we speak about a law of the Torah, an halakha, the concept of halakha, in terms of saying, if we just live like that, there will be absolute peace between all the different values. Everything like in a jigsaw puzzle will fall together. Every piece belongs somewhere. On the end, you have the big picture, and that's what it is. Isaiah Berlin says, nowhere is there any evidence in the world that there is anything like that. My question, therefore, is this again not something which undermines the whole concept of the Jewish tradition, which keeps on telling us that we ultimately must live by the halakha, and the halakha has the final solution to the problems, and thereby, if we follow it carefully, everything shall be well? Well, in fact, it seems that that doesn't work. Did the halakha ever really find an ultimate solution to the problems which we are confronted with? And if it does, how can it be that there are so many differences of opinion within the halakha? All these matters are incredibly important. So I am asking, and here I will stop to make a little break. We have two problems which really are one. We have the problem of prepared experience. versus spontaneity, the need to be involved with God instead of with the halakha. Then we have the problem of autonomy on one side and the need for the Jewish tradition to constantly say, no, you need to listen. And on top of that, we decide, we the rabbis decide for you how to live your life, and that's the end of the story. We need conformity by all means and by all ways. And that is a completely clashing with the reality which we live, that we only work in a world where there are trade-offs when it comes to the greatest and the most beautiful values in this world. If that's the case, we have a major problem. I will try to deal with this problem after the break. Mm-hmm.